lectures, three or four lectures, are going to be devoted to finding the spectrum of a free closed bosonic string. So yesterday we sketched how to find scattering amplitudes, but now we will just step back a little bit and just look at a free theory before we introduce any interactions. So I would like to show you, for example, that why the spectrum of the string includes a graviton. So concretely, that means that we are going to study a string whose trajectory in space-time looks like a cylinder. So yesterday we concluded that in order to study the propagation of a string, we can use a path integral involving a bunch of scalar fields, one for each direction of space-time. And then we had to discuss to figure out what to do with a metric and so on. But for now, for today, we just focused on the scalar fields. Okay? So I want to just remind you of a few facts about the quantization of a scalar field, of a free scalar on a two-dimensional space, which with a topology of a cylinder. Okay. Now, as I discussed yesterday, I will put a flat metric on a cylinder. I can do it globally instead of just locally. There's definitely no problem putting a flat metric on a cylinder. And if I want to keep the metric a little bit generic, so I can parameterize the cylinder by two coordinates, a space and a time. So because I have a cylinder, I want to identify the space direction. For now, I'm going to give the cylinder length width L. As we saw, the theory is actually Weyl invariant, so I can change the size of the cylinder without changing any of the physics. I will just keep L for now for some educational purposes, and then at some point I will set L to 1. Now, so when you study quantum field theory, you surely studied the theory of a free scalar, and you probably studied it using canonical quantization. What does it mean? You forgot for a moment about Lorentz variance. You just wrote down the Hamiltonian for this field theory and studied the behavior, studied the states in the Fock space. And the first step is to decompose, if you do things in canonical quantization, is to take your field as a function of space and decompose it in Fourier modes. And then the Hamiltonian becomes the sum of a bunch of harmonic oscillators, one for each mode. Now, if you're working on a cylinder, you're going to use an expansion in discrete Fourier modes. So you could do something like, at 0 plus sum of x n. So you could do, for example, something like this. You could expand your field in Fourier mode, plug it into the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is going to be something like this. roughly. So when you plug this expansion inside, you get something like a sum of x dot x minus n dot plus n squared x n x minus n, something like that, n over square. So you get a bunch of harmonic oscillators whose frequencies is proportional to n, n over l. And so you know how the Hilbert space of your system is going to look like. So you can separate the zero mode. The zero mode is just behaves like a just a free particle. It's just as a Hamiltonian x dot squared. And then you have these sort of oscillator modes. So let's try to describe the Hilbert space. The zero mode will give you a Hilbert space which is the same as the Hilbert space of a free particle defined on a line. So you have a bunch of momentum modes for the zero mode. And then you have your oscillator, your infinite family of oscillators. You can pick a ground, you can take this to be a ground state for those oscillators. And then you will have creation operators that act on this ground state and build a whole Fock space. So let me write this expression. This expansion is slightly more convenient fashion. And let me put back time. And also, again, for future convenience, let me work with Euclidean time. So I'm going to find tau to be it. I mean, for studying the Fock, the Hilbert space, doesn't make any difference if you work with Euclidean time or Minkowski time. And in computing scattering amplitude or static string theory, it's useful, at least at the beginning, to just work with Euclidean worksheets. It's much simpler to work with complex coordinate transformations than and complex coordinates are available if you have a Euclidean worksheet. But when you get really deeper into the details of calculation of scattering amplitude, sometimes it's useful to consider more general possibilities. There was a beautiful article last year of Witten on how to deal properly with things like the I epsilon prescription in string theory, the string theory equivalent to the I epsilon prescription that requires to think about slightly more general things than Euclidean worksheets. But for most of your studies of string theory, Euclidean worksheets are perfectly fine. So once I put time back in, I can expand my scalar field operator, but let me just drop the hats. Everything we're doing is quantum mechanical anyway. Okay, I hope this is all readable. This is a sigma plus I tau. This is sigma minus I tau. So what I've done compared to this, essentially, is that I've rewritten the excess in terms of creation and destruction operators. and just changed a bit of notations and normalizations to make things more convenient. So these ANs are just creation and destruction operators. So they all commute except for these relations. And then X and P are the usual position and momentum. Okay, so I use the slightly peculiar notation. Usually when you study the harmonic oscillator, you have a creation and destruction operators, which are usually denoted as A and A bar, and A bar gives you one. Here I use a slightly different notation where the creation and destruction operators are denoted as AN and A minus N. And then there is a second set, A bar N, A bar minus N. So these correspond to, say, positive Fourier modes, creation and destruction operators for positive Fourier modes. And these are creation and destruction operator for negative Fourier modes. Again, it's not as complicated as it is. If you just looked at the, essentially part of the point is that here you see x n x minus n were conjugate to each other. So if you just do the exercise at home of studying a complex harmonic oscillator, then you would, this formula would look more familiar. Okay, so right, and x and p are just, so X represents the motion of this. So let's think about this a bit more physically. X represents the position or the center of mass of your string. P is the conjugate momentum to that, is the speed or the center of, is the momentum of the center of mass of the string. And these ones, these operators create oscillations on the string. So the basic ground states of this Fock space represent a string which is not oscillating and is just moving it with momentum p. And then you can create other states. So this space, for example, represent a string which is moving with momentum p and has one quantum of a wave moving along it. After you could visualize it. Well, I'm really poor at drawing, but something like that. Well, it's dynamical. So if you work in real time, the positive modes move to the left and the negative modes move to the right. Right? If you pluck a string, you'll see a move, an infinite string. You'll see a wave that moves towards the left and a wave that moves towards the right. Right. I'm organizing the states by their energy in, well, this, you need to be careful. This is not the energy in space-time. This is the energy on the worksheet. So it's the generator that's associated with translations along the worksheet. So in terms of this Hamiltonian, these states roughly have energy p square over 2, and then these have p square over 2 plus 1, p square over 2 plus 2, and so on and so forth. Now, so today I just drop every mention of the metric, right? Because we discussed yesterday we can gauge fix it away with the form of Fismius Wild transformations. But as usual in gauge theories, even if you gauge away some field, you cannot completely forget about it. You still have the equations of motions for that field, classically. Quantum mechanically, you need to find ways to impose the equations of motions as some sort of a constraint. The correct way to do it is to use ghosts, and we'll do that in a couple lessons. For now, we'll do things a bit by hand, like you probably did in QED. Remember, in QED, classically, you need to set the current to zero. Quantum mechanically, you cannot quite do that because the current is an operator. It creates things out of the vacuum. And what you do is typically you split it into positive modes, into creation and destruction operators, and you require that the destruction operators kill all the physical states. So we'll do this tomorrow, but for now let me just discuss what the current is. Okay, so the current should be the variation of the action with respect to the quantity which we gauge fixed away. If you're trying to write down the equations that came out from extremizing the metric. So the variation of the action with respect to the metric is called a stress tensor. It's a very important quantity in quantum field theory. Now, if your theory is diffeomorphism invariant, so that the action is invariant under H goes to HAB plus DA DB plus DB VA. I should probably put quantum derivatives. Then the stress tensor, so that means the sum of these variations are zero. And this is the conservation of the stress tensor. If the metric is invariant under wider scaling, that implies that the stress tensor is traceless. Let me just write it. Okay. So these are classical statements. If you want these symmetries to hold quantum mechanically, you better find find a definition of this as an operator, which still satisfies these conservation laws. Conversely, these wild anomalies we discussed yesterday manifest themselves into a failure of this condition to hold quantum mechanically. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. So to find out what are the physical states of the string, what are the states that are compatible with the gauge symmetry with gauge fixed, we will have to understand how the stress tensor looks like in this theory of the free boson. Now, let's go there. We could do that just carefully, starting from the definition. So the action of the the scalar field looks like this. It takes a little bit of work to do the partial derivative and write that tensor, and I'm not gonna spend the time to do that, but I encourage you to do it yourself. Instead, I will just write a stress tensor, and I'll write it so it's convenient to actually lower the indices. And go in complex coordinates. So remember, we want to compute these, but we want to compute it in flat space. So you're gonna vary the space of the metric and then set the metric to be flat. And because we're in flat space, we can as well use complex coordinates. And after you do that, things simplify considerably. There's probably a 1/2, which I always, and a minus, I always forget. So remember that in complex coordinates, you write the metric has only one. Two components, which is HC Z bar. The flat metric is just the Z bar. Some I there. So this is the trace of the stress tensor. It's automatically zero, at least classically. And these are the other components of the stress tensor, which are the ones we are interested in. By the way, even quantum mechanically, when you get a Weyl anomaly, the right-hand side is non-zero, but it's a function of the metric. It's actually the curvature. And so it's zero in flat space. So in as we do most of our calculations in flat space, we'll be typically unable to see that this bar wants to be non-zero quantum mechanically. But I will show you how could you, in principle, derive the correct relation in the general space-time. Okay, so we need to study expressions like this, quantum mechanically. Okay. Now, where the let me just define the complex coordinates. The complex coordinate on the cylinder for us, let me just denote with S, it's going to be tau minus I sigma. Okay. So there are a few statements which follow from this formula. Let me write them down. So first of all, just as a sanity check, let me make sure that X has the correct commutation relations. This is actually what's usually the, in canonical quantization, this would be the starting point, if you want. So there are some equal time commutation relations. And just writing them down to match sort of things you would write down in canonical quantization, but we will never use these sort of expressions. So it was just to check that I didn't mess up anything when I picked these conventions. Then all normalizations are working out right. So with these commutators and this definition, you get the correct state, the correct result that X and his moment, conjugate momentum commute unless they are at the same place in space. Now, a more useful observation also in preparation to studying this sort of expression is to look at the following current, the following object. Now, this is a conserved current simply because the Laplacian of X is zero. It's actually the current associated to translations of X. And if you write it in complex coordinates, it's actually quite neat. So you see the holomorphic part of the current only involves the left movers, the modes without a bar. JS bar would involve the A bars. Okay. And more importantly, if you have a conserved current, you would current conservation will be usually written like this. But in this free theory, you find something slightly stronger. The holomorphic and anti-holomorphic parts of the current are separately conserved. J is holomorphic. JS is holomorphic in S. So this is rather important. and if you want to understand why this is happening, you can observe that this equation implies a more general relation. It's not just the current Jz that is conserved, it's Jz multiplied by any holomorphic function. Why is that? Well, because the equations of motion of the scalar field, or even the action of the scalar field, well, equation of motion, are unchanged if you shift the scalar field, not just by a constant, but by any harmonic function, which is an holomorphic function plus an anti-holomorphic function. It's not very terribly deep. I mean, this is a free theory. Free theories are full of symmetries. So it's not surprising that you can find all sorts of symmetries and all sorts of conserved currents. But this is instructive for a different reason. Let's write down the conservation of stress tensor. Because this is zero, the left of this. So the holomorphic part of T is holomorphic. I mean, the part that has only holomorphic indices is actually holomorphic. And you can get an enhanced sort of conservation law. So usually the stress tensor is the current for translations. Here you find the symmetry for a more complicated current. Associated to a more complicated current, this is a current which associated transformation holomorphic coordinate transformations. So as we discussed yesterday or sketched yesterday, the diffeomorphism invariance plus wild symmetry implies in particular invariance under holomorphic coordinate transformations in flat space. And This manifests itself in the quantum field theory as the presence of all of these infinite constant currents. Now, in the free theory, in the free scalar theory, this fact is obvious. We said that this is holomorphic, so its square is definitely also holomorphic. Okay, so let's try to do. Now, next, I would like to try to define the stress tensor in the quantum theory. So this expression is not terribly good, because it involves two fields placed at the same location in space-time. So it has some divergence, and it needs to be, which needs to be cured. Curing this divergence is closely related to regularizing the measure of the path integral, the naive measure of the path integral. So you can guess that somehow the Weyl anomaly, if there is a place where this Weyl anomaly will start popping out, would be in how we regularize the stress tensor. So let's do some more calculations. So let's try to see how badly does this expression behave. To do so, I'm going to compute in this formalism a two-point function, a correlation function. I put a vacuum in the future and in the past, and I will put these currents. H locations in along the cylinder. So I'm computing something like this, with the two currents inserted at two points in the vacuum in the past and in the future. I'm going to cheat a little and pretend that this vacuum is normalizable. Because we have the zero mode, these are really that delta function normalizable. So I should really put P and P prime and put a delta of P minus P prime. But let me just focus on the oscillator modes. So this is very easy. I just plug in that expression, or better, this expression. Use the commutation relations to bring all the distraction operators to the right to kill the vacuum. And so I'm left with something very simple. I'm assuming, I believe that S prime is before S. I don't remember. One of the two. Yes, S prime is before S. But the final expression will be, I mean, you get the same answer no matter which one you do. Again, I'm sorry for the 1 over L I'm dragging along, but I'll get rid of it very soon. Okay. So you see that as you bring dx and dx prime close to each other, there is a divergence. And divergence roughly behaves as 1 over S minus S prime squared. Okay. As S goes to S prime. Indeed, if you take the limit of an infinitely large cylinder so that you go to flat space, this will become just 1 over S minus S prime squared. So if you were in flat space, you could define the stress tensor just by normal ordering. Okay, that's the canonical way you have found, I guess, in studying quantum field theory to regularize composite operators. Normal ordering means essentially subtracting the vacuum expectation value. So in flat space, you define the stress tensor like this, taking the limit as z goes to z prime. So to compute the correlation function of the stress tensor, you just plug this ugly thing in the correlation function and then take the limit. Okay, this is fine. And right, and in flat space, this was precisely the same as the expectation value of this. Now, if you're on the cylinder tour, you don't quite want to use normal ordering, because if you were to do that, you would be defining the stress tensor as ds prime x of s prime plus this expression. Now this would be pretty bad because you're trying to define a local operator. A local operator in quantum theory should only depend on local quantities, on local properties of your theory. If you define your local operators in a way they depend on what's going on very far away, you're breaking a very beautiful property of quantum field theory, which is the separation of scales. Things will start behaving very badly. So you definitely cannot do something like that that depends on the size of your cylinder. Instead, we will just subtract the local divergence. So we're going to define our stress tensor on the cylinder by the same expression. This definitely gives me a good local definition of the operator, has no divergences. It's still holomorphic, so I'm okay with my conservation laws. So this would be the definition of the stress tensor. Okay. Now, now I can do the first calculation with the stress tensor. I can compute the expectation value of the stress tensor. Okay. There's going to be a limit as s goes to s prime of minus 1/2 of minus 1 over L squared e to the s as s prime over to the s over l minus e to the s prime over l squared. Plus 1 over s minus s prime squared. Okay. You can do this calculation by yourself or with Mathematica if you're lazy, but so the answer is just minus 1 over 24 L squared. does it mean? So by definition, the expectation value of the stress tensor in flat space is zero. But on the cylinder, we find a non-zero answer. Well, it's a constant answer. It's actually the same for TSS and for TS bar S bar. And if you look at what it means, it's just a constant energy density. And it's just the Casimir energy for the theory on a cylinder. Whenever you put a quantum field theory in a space that is not infinite, you get a Casimir energy. It's just what's left out of the. Well, see, suppose you were to ask what is the energy of the vacuum, right? And you treated each of these oscillators as an independent harmonic oscillator. So each harmonic oscillator would contribute naively n over L to the energy, right? N over true L. And you would add them up, and you'll get infinity, of course. Because this is essentially what you get if you're trying to look at, this is the same as doing the calculation without subtracting this. Now, at this point, you can do things properly like this, or you can just wave your hands and pretend there are good ways to add up all the integers from 1 to infinity. If you wave your hands in the right way, you get something like minus 1/12, and you reproduce this answer. The correct hand waving, correct way to hand wave your hand is called zeta function regularization. But it's actually not trivial to. So zeta function regularization is a nice mathematical trick, but it's actually non-trivial to show that it's the correct physical thing to do. If you do it like this, you just do the calculation physically. You get the answer. As I said, it's sort of intricate. And if you look at the last year lecture, I spent some time to explain it. But I had more time than I have today. I can also tell you after the lecture, if I remember it. Checking last year lecture might be easier. Right. Because for this year, I want to make another aside instead. So something like an exercise that you could do if you had the energy. So here everything was done in flat space. But suppose you really wanted to recover the Weyl anomaly in its full glory. What should you do? Well, you can just work in a space with a generic metric. So you can take your free boson with generic metric. Right? You can write your stress tensor. Which I don't remember. So it's surely something like this. And then probably something like this, but check me out on this. I tend to forget formulae easily. And then you want to define it in the quantum theory, you need to subtract something. So you're going to take the limit, compute this as some u, and this is some u prime. And subtract somehow as something singular. So again, you cannot, if you want to do normal ordering, you would just subtracting something built out of the full propagator on your spacetime. But you don't want to do that. Then you want to just subtract as little as you can, just the singular part of this, or the expression on the left hand side. And you want to do it in a way that is diffeomorphism invariant. It looks Ugly, I believe you do it in normal coordinates for the point where you're working. Things should simplify considerably. This expression will be some function. It's a lot of essentially the metric and its derivatives, but only at that point, because you want to do things locally. And then after you build an expression that is invariant under diffeomorphisms, you can take the trace. And on the right-hand side, it should pop out the curvature. This should keep you occupied for a couple hours. And it's sort of the generalization of these simple calculations. Right, but in particular, so whatever the curvature pops out is some number in front, which is the anomaly, the specific number which is attached to every theory and tells you how anomalous it is. And you can, as you can guess, that same number pops out in this sort of calculations. So when you compute the expectation value of the stress tensor for some theory, not the free scalar, instead of getting minus 1 over 24 L squared, you're going to get something like C over 24 L squared. So the same constant will pop out here. So this is a cheap way to compute the anomaly for the free boson. It's 1 in appropriate units. Then we repeat the exercise for the ghost. We get the minus 26 and find how to cancel the anomaly. Okay, so I would like now to elaborate a little bit more about the stress tensor. So as I said, this definition is not normal ordering. But it differs from normal ordering in a very simple way. We just computed the difference between the normal, what you would subtract in normal ordering, and what you subtract in a proper definition. Which means that this messy expression can be written as just the normal ordering of minus 1 over 24 L squared. Okay, so normal ordering is quite good, it just misses a constant. Okay, so let's write down this normal ordered expression. I have a curiosity. So I keep jumping between blackboard and blackboard in the effort of not erasing anything. If you find it confusing, let me know, and then I'll just try to focus in some location of the blackboards and erase. Okay, so I have dS here, dSx, d sigma x here. So I want to compute. From now on, I'm happy to set L equal to 1, because the only reason I wanted L was to discuss why the subtraction, the naive subtraction, was not okay. So I can get rid of L. And so T is just 1/2 J minus 1 over 24. So it's okay, so just normal ordered expression. And it's conventional to denote the Fourier modes of the stress tensor as L. So you can write this as 1 over 24, minus 1 over 24, plus sum over n ln e to the minus ns. So now going back to this currents, if you have a current, how do you compute the conserved charge? Just integrate the current over your space, which essentially means you pick the zero mode of the current, in the Fourier expansion of the current. So if I pick my, if I pick this G to be some monomial like Z to the N KZZ, and I take the zero mode, sorry, I meant e to the ns tss, and I pick the zero mode, I'm going to just pick one of these modes. Okay? So these Ls are just generators of some transformations, of some coordinate transformations. They're called the Virasoro. So the algebra of coordinate transformations, complex coordinate transformation, is called the Virasoro algebra. And these operators give a representation of this Virasoro algebra. So let me commute the commutation. Let me just compute the commutation relations. so. It's a little tedious to do it by hand. More seriously, if you do it starting from this expression, you end up again with this sort of sums of powers of integers, and then you have to find how to regularize them. So it's useful to again step a little bit back, go back to the definition, do the calculation, and then expanding Fourier modes. So instead of computing the commutator between Ln and Lm, we're going to compute the commutator between Ln and the stress tensor, and then we're going to expand that in Fourier modes. So one thing at a time. So first of all, we can compute this. This you can do fine just from the definition. You use this expression, you use these correlators, these commutators, and you get m a of n plus m. Okay. Then we can reassemble these to compute this commutator. This looks complicated, but if you think about it, if you stare at it for a little bit, it will start making sense. As I said, the Virasoro algebra is the algebra of coordinate transformations, holomorphic coordinate transformations, is an algebra of vector fields. And this is kind of the, is pretty close to how a vector field, it is essentially how a vector field would act on the derivative of a scalar field. I mean, if you just remove the derivative, you'll see it right away. So this is a vector field acting on a function. So this is how it acts on the derivative of the function. No surprises here. And then some slightly more tedious steps. I might have messed up some eyes. Again, this is just pretty boring. I'm acting on one of them or on the other and adding up. Then finally, the slightly less boring step is to take the limit, subtract this and take the limit. And so the result okay, so the first line is essentially the classical, the naive answer. Okay, this is precisely how the classical stress tensor would have transformed under the diffeomorphism. And this is the interesting part. Yes. Yes, the L's are gonna commute with anti-holomorphic components. I'm sorry, for reason of time, just focus on the holomorphic component of the tensor. T S bar has exactly the same properties and gives rise to another set of modes, which are the, which act on S bar. They're like the anti-holomorphic vector fields. But right, so this is the crucial correction, which would have been a bit tricky computed right away from the definition. So now we can expand this in modes, and we finally get the Virasoro algebra. So again, this 1 in 1 over 12 is a specific property of the free boson theory and is the anomaly of the free boson theory. If you look at the generic theory, you would have gotten the C, the central charge. Now, mathematically, this extra term is something that's called the central extension. So you had your algebra of differential operators, which satisfy this commutation relation without this extra term. And then you see that your algebra is corrected by amounts that are just numbers, constants. So it's like your group has been augmented by a group which acts on things just by multiplying them by something, by a phase. So this group of coordinate transformations to be augmented by a transformation which is just multiplying everything by some constant. And this transformation and this extension is non-trivial. It cannot be eliminated by a redefinition of your generators. That's what the central extension is called. And central extension can be classified by some mathematical construction. So in terms, if you go back to think about the measure, right, you can so you have this measure is defined up to redefinitions of the measure, and you're trying to define the action of these vector fields on them on that. And because when you do coordinate transformation, you're your regularization changes, essentially this multiplication, this redefinition, the multiplication by something gets mixed up with your original symmetry, and you find a central extension of the original symmetry. Okay, so tomorrow we're gonna use this frame modes of the stress tensor to impose the physical condition on the string states. And so we'll start seeing what is the spectrum of a string.